Well, first of all, what a powerful book this was. And yes, it's about baseball, but it's about so much more: family, faith, friendship, and about finding strength in some unimaginable circumstances.
Yes. You know, when I first thought about writing this book, number one, Eric Sherman brought all that stuff out of me. That was buried for so long. That's a really open question, Rich, and I don't know how to direct it other than there's so many issues that happened during our life. To be honest with you, I really never enjoyed my playing time because there was so much downtime with my boys and their illnesses. And they had what they call neurofibromatosis, and we will call it NF, and really a debilitating disease. It starts out with deformity, tumors that grow on end of nerves and areas that are tough. And if you've ever had when you get a filling filled and they blow that cold air or cold water on that open tooth, that's a nerve, and to have these tumors grow, it's very painful. Another part of it is learning disabilities that go along with it, and then finally it turns to cancer, and that's where we lost our two boys, and they both died within 10 months of each other. And both had glioblastoma, which is brain cancer. And, my wife and I, we do talk about it because it is healing to talk about it. And there's times we just don't want to talk about it. But like I said, it is healing. But we were so, our lives were so enriched with having them in our lives as long as we did. And they were very sick, and we miss them. I'm not saying we're, it's not in the order of things, Rich. It's your grandparents go, and then your parents go. But the children aren't supposed to go before the parents. And it's just not in the order of things. And it's a tough time for us, but we have gotten through it just by knowing and by remembering all the good times and even bad times that they enriched our lives. And again, wouldn't want them back because they were so ill, and unless they were healthy. And that's just a wish. That's all.
Well, it was great to get to know them a little bit through the book and learn about their attitude, sense of humor, being hard workers, and really brought them to life in this story. So as somebody who knew only a little bit about what was going on for your boys and your family, it was great to find out more about Justin and Timothy.
Yeah, they would come in. To the ballpark with me, and then they'd go across the street to I'm sure most of your fans have been to Fenway, and they had that souvenir shop across the street, but they'd go in there and work, and they loved it. And there was one story that's not in the book, which is okay, but I had a tough night with my oldest son, Tim, was working across the street. And I had a tough night at the plate. I was just like airheading it. And I was so involved in what happened. After the game, I usually leave like an hour after the game. I got in the car and drove home. And Eddie Miller, who's a good friend, runs that souvenir shop across the street. I get a call. I get home and I get a call from Eddie Miller. And he says, Dwight, did you forget something? I said, no, why? He goes, are you sure? And I said, I'm pretty sure. He goes, you didn't forget Tim, now, did you? And I went, I forgot. I left him there at the ballpark. And Tim was just a tough kid. He said, I'm walking home. He was going to walk on 93 at 128 to get to Linfield. And Eddie says, I'll bring him home. And he brought him home. But I had some moments like that that I airheaded it. That was one of my weakest moments. But that's how involved I was in the game. And I tell that. My wife likes to tell that because she likes to hammer on me a little bit. So.
Well, speaking of that.
He was a great kid.
Speaking of that, after reading the book, I would say this. How fortunate for you that Susan didn't take it personally when you elbowed her in the head on your first date.
Oh, Rich, you're right. We were 15. And I finally, I was so shy. And I asked her if she'd go see The Graduate with me. That's when The Graduate came out in 1969. And I was really feeling good about myself and nervous at the same time, going, I got to put my arm around her. And I lifted my arm up, and my elbow hit her right in the forehead. And that was a humbling moment. So it didn't hurt her, but I mean, it's just embarrassing because I was trying to be so smooth and by putting my arm around her. So it wasn't so smooth.
More than 50 years later, here you are. It turns out, too, you were a pretty shrewd negotiator for a 17-year-old when it came time to think about signing a pro contract.
You know, I love telling that story. It's a little lengthy. I don't know how much time we have, but...
All the time you need.
Okay, so I am 17 years old, and my senior year, my junior year, I started getting these index cards, and they'd have the logo of the team, like the Cardinals, the Red Sox, or the Giants, or Dodgers, or whatever. And I got about four or five of them. And I was like, I was 15. Actually, I was 16. I take that back. I was 16. So the following year, my senior year, I'm 17. And I got about 14 cards. And there's 20 teams. But I never got one from the Red Sox. And I didn't even really know who the Red Sox were. I mean, I'm living in L.A. I'm thinking Dodgers. I'm thinking maybe the Angels or the Giants or something like that, or Cubs or Cardinals. And we found out by looking in the newspaper the next day where you were drafted and who you were drafted by. I was number 104 in the country at 17. And I'm signed by the Boston Red Sox. And I really didn't know who they were. Didn't follow them being on the West Coast and being a big Dodger fan at that time. I get a call that afternoon from Joe Stevenson, who was the scout that signed me, or that drafted me. And he goes, I'd love to come over and try to get you signed, meet your parents, and see if we can get you signed. And I said, great. So he came over the next day, and he sits down in our living room, and I'm on the couch, and my parents are on each side of me, and sitting pretty close to me. We didn't have money. We had food on the table. We didn't have much money at all. And he's talking about the Boston Red Sox. And he's saying, goes on for about 15 minutes, how what a great organization, how I would be great to be with them, and the fit would be great. And he said, we're willing to offer you $7,500. And now I'm getting an elbow from my father and my mother and my ribs sitting next to me. Like, this is more money than we've ever seen, you know? And I had talked to my coach, a high school coach, who meant a lot to me. And his name was Coach Matula. And I asked him what I should be looking for. And he said, I wouldn't sign for less than $10,000. I mean, you know, I don't know how money is or whatever. So when I said I won't sign for $7,500, he threw his arms up in the air and went like, all right, kid. All right, what's it going to take to sign you? I said, I want $10,500 and I want a college education. Now he throws his arms up in the air and he goes, I don't have the authority to sign you to that kind of that kind of a package, is I'm going to have to call the Boston Red Sox. So back then, we only had one phone in the house, and that, of course, it had a cord on it with a, you know, a spring cord that would go like 60 feet to all parts of the house.
Right.
And he gets on the phone, he's in the kitchen, and now he's only like 20 feet from us, but he's behind a wall where I can't see him, but we could hear him. And he is talking really nice about me. And, you know, how great it would be for me to sign, and the Red Sox would benefit from this kid, and seeing all these things. And my parents on the other side are hammering on me. What happens if he says no? What happens? What are you going to do? I mean, it's $7,500. You're crazy. And I said, well, I had a possibility of a, I love football. And I had a promise to go to University of Wisconsin and play football. And I said, I'll go to Wisconsin and play football. I really didn't want to go. I grew up in Hawaii and California, came to California at 10 years old. I didn't want to go to Wisconsin and play football. So anyway, Joe Stevenson comes back. He sits down in front of the sofa again, and he says, well, kid, you're quite the negotiator. The Boston Red Sox just told me to go ahead and sign it at $10,500, and you got that college education. And so now my parents are really happy. So 2 days later, I go to Jamestown, New York, get on a plane and go to Jamestown, New York to start playing professional baseball at the age of 17. So now I do not hear from Joe Stevenson again. I mean, I get to the major leagues. I elevate through the system, our minor league system, pretty quick. I get to the major leagues at 20. And I don't get a call from this guy. And that's okay. I've got other things I've got to do and move on. And, you know, he signs kids, and then he kind of doesn't have anything to say about them going forward. So I become, this is 33 years later. Fast forward from 1969 to 2002, I become the hitting coach for the Boston Red Sox. So the writers come up with an award to give me, coming back into the organization, this sort of thing. And they fly in 82-year-old Joe Stevenson.
Wow.
To present the award to me. And we're backstage, we're catching up. And again, have not seen this guy in 33 years or heard from him. And he told me how proud he was of me and this and that. And then one thing I didn't know, when he got in front of the mic, you know, there's some people that love the mic, but the mic doesn't love them.
Right.
And there's some people that love the mic and the mic loves them and they do well. And you're one of those guys, Rich. And he was too. He loved the mic and he was so eloquent in the way he spoke and his story, talking about other things. He talked about me, said I was the best player he ever signed. He went on and on. He goes, the one thing that Dwight and his family never knew. Now I'm looking at him 33 years later, and he says, when I told Dwight I had to call the Boston Red Sox, what I did is I got on the phone, and I called my wife for 15 minutes and told her how good Dwight was. So 33 years of me going that he finally called the Red Sox, thinking that story was, he held that for 33
wow.
years. I like the story because it's that's patience for me.
That is
years of waiting to tell that story.
That is a great story. We're talking with Dwight Evans here on Downtown. You mentioned you made it to the majors at 20, and you found a couple of mentors and friends right away in Carl Yastrzemski and our friend Rico Petrocelli.
Yes. They were great to me. I mean, you know, I'm 20, and, you know, they're you know, 30, 31, 32, and they treated me. We were in a pennant race. I was 72. We were in a pennant race, and they brought me up. I had just finished AAA, and I was MVP there, and I felt pretty good about myself, but I didn't know what to expect in the major leagues. But they took me and guided me and took care. Reggie Smith was the same way. They all three just kind of brought me along and showed me the ropes of being in the major leagues and how to act on and off the field. So I'm always grateful of that. And then, you know, Carl and I became friends pretty quick. I was like, he was like an older brother to me. And Rico was too. So, but I was 13 years with Carl. Carl retired in 83. But it was 13 years with Carl. And met a lot to me. Taught me how to play the game. And one thing that he taught me was, and Jim Rice and I talk about this, Jimmy and I played 16 years together, that Yaz taught us how to play hurt. Mm. And what do I mean by that? Well, and Jimmy and I talk about it all the time. You know, Jimmy's had both knees replaced. I've had a bunch of surgeries, one knee replaced. And you're always hurt. And if we only played when we were healthy, we never would have played. But people will go, well, oh, he's a tough guy. You know, he plays hurt. But Carl taught us how to produce hurt. And, I mean, when you break something, you can't play. When you tear a tendon or a muscle, you can't play. But when you have some issues that bad back or things that you can get loose and get going and your legs are hurting, your knees are hurting, your body's hurting, you're coming off AstroTurf onto regular turf. And back then, AstroTurf was running on concrete. So your body hurt a lot. And he taught us how to play through that. And forever grateful for that. And when I always saw somebody that wouldn't play, you know, they had bumps and bruises and wouldn't play, I'd get upset with them. I would. But try to teach them the same things.
You write in the book that you and Ted Williams did not always see eye to eye. He finally came around late in life and invited you down to Florida for his Hitters Hall of Fame.
His Hitters, he did. And his Hitters Hall of Fame, there were some guys that are in the Hall of Fame. There were guys that weren't in the Hall of Fame. So it was, when he was alive, it was pretty prestigious to be inducted into it. But I'm 20 years old. I mean, Mike, this is 1972. I'm 20 years old. And I'm in my first major league camp. And back then, we were in Winter Haven. There was 40-man roster was always on one field. So you got a lot of players on one field. And I'm in right field, and I'm shagging batting practice. And Ted's behind second base about 40 feet. And he's got a fungo hanging from his right hand. He's got his arms crossed, and the fungo's just hanging down by his left leg. And I said, well, I'm going to go say hello to Ted. Not knowing him. And again, I'm 20, my first major league camp. And I come up, and he's watching batting practice. And if a line drive was hit him, he just lift one leg up and let it go by, move his head one side to the other if it came out of his head. He wouldn't panic. You know, he's very, very smooth in what he's doing. And I said, Ted, Dwight Evans here, in a booming voice. He goes, I know who you are. and I'm like, and I was shy. I was so shy. And I just talked to him for like 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm getting yes, yes and no, and just one word answers. And then finally, I run out of things to say to him. I said, Ted, I'm going to head out, but I got one thing I wanted to ask you. What is it, kid? And I said, what were you thinking on counts like 2-0 and 3-1? Well, he threw that fungo up in there about 40 feet, not knowing where it was going to land. And he turns towards me, and the first time he looks at me, now he starts airing me out. And his voice, again, if Ted was in a locker room, and we had a big locker room in Winter Haven, and there was two different sections of it. He'd be in the back room. You could hear everything he's saying, the story he's talking about. You could hear it. And, well, he's a little loud with this one coming at me. He goes, how can you be in a big league camp and ask me a stupid question like that? And I went, well, now I don't know what to say. I'm listening to him. He keeps going after me. But now the people in the stands are all looking into short right field. And because you could hear Ted all over the field, and it went on. And then Now the guy throwing batting practice on the mound turns around and stops throwing batting practice. Everybody is looking at us, on the field and off the field. I finally tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Ted, it must be a bad day. I'll talk to you some other time. And I turned around and walked away. If I had a shovel and could have dug my way out of there, I'd have done that. I walked away, totally embarrassed, so much embarrassed that I didn't talk to Ted for 4 years. And he was always in spring training. He'd show up at Fenway now and then. I just didn't talk to him. I didn't want that encounter again. So, and then again, as I played more and more, he started talking to me in a different way. And again, 2002, he puts me into his Hitters Hall of Fame. And I can remember him coming up to me, and his voice was weak at that time. And I took it as a compliment because he meant it. He goes, "You should have been better than you were." And some people take that as a disappointing statement, but he was saying, "I just inducted you in my Hitters Hall of Fame, but you could have been better than you were," is what he was saying. And I took that as, that's the closest thing I had of a compliment from Ted. And I loved Ted. I did. I loved him for what he stood for. Here's a guy that was in World War II for 3 years and the Korean War, spent 5 years in the prime of his career to serve our country. And we had a guy named John Wayne who was on the silver screen and played a hero like Ted Williams. Ted Williams did it,
right,
and lived it. And they say he landed a jet in Korea that was so full of holes, they don't know how he kept it airborne. But he landed just over the border from North Korea. And he would have been a prize prisoner for the North Koreans. But served his country. And then, after all that time off, came back and still was productive. What a great ball player, but a great American and really a great human being.
You write a lot about the 75 team and the World Series, and you still believe, as a lot of us do, that was the greatest World Series of all time.
A six game, it's been called that, not by me, but by writers and media that were around that time and how they rated World Series, and it was not only a great World Series, but for me, it was the last pure World Series. And what I mean by that, Rich, is that it was, you couldn't, free agency just broke in. Catfish Hunter went from Oakland to the Yankees in 75. And so that was just the first of it. And then Dave McNally in Montreal, same kind of thing. So it wasn't really a popular thing at that point, but what I mean by pure World Series is you could only build a team through trades,
right,
or through your own system. And we actually had 19 homegrown players on that team, which is unheard of. Now you can, and Steinbrenner did it. He bought his teams, but I think it was one of the greatest World Series. And then the sixth game. I'm actually standing on third base. They're changing pitchers, and Pete Rose, and I don't know how he knew my name at that time. I'm 23. He says, "Dewey, this might be the greatest game I've ever played in." And he says, "Isn't this great?" And I started looking around at the situation and looking at the score. And that time, the score was tied, and Carbo just hit his three-run home run. And I'm turning around looking at everything, and I'm trying to here's Pete Rose telling me this is the greatest game that he's ever played in. Now I'm kind of green because I'm so involved with being a World Series and not really looking at the situation, but it was a moment. I think he also made that statement to Carlton Fisk as well.
And you mentioned in the book, and I couldn't agree more, Carlton Fisk's home run deservedly has become the stuff of legend, but that Bernie Carbo pinch hit home run was even bigger because we don't get to the Fisk homer without Carbo first.
I don't make a catch in right field in
right.
the 11th inning if Carbo doesn't hit that three-run home run. There's a lot of history that never would have happened if Carbo didn't hit that home run. And the biggest – I rate home runs this way. The biggest home run I ever saw was Dave Henderson's in the 86 yeah. playoff game in Anaheim. We were down three runs and one strike left on Henderson. He kept fouling off balls. Finally, it's a home run. We have all the police, stadium police around on the field and in our dugout. They shoved us down the runway. And I could only see a little bit through their legs, just trying to, we're eight steps down from the field, just trying to see Henderson hit. And finally he hit, and all I could see is, I couldn't see him because he jumped so high. We finally saw it after the game. But that was the biggest home run that I ever saw. And Carbo's was the second, and Fisk, not taking anything away from him. That's just my perception, not putting anybody down. It's just, Fisk was a great and most celebrated home run, you know, World Series history. So I'm just giving my two cents of what I thought was the biggest, and I stand by it.
And that play you made out in right field, do I remember right from the book that you couldn't quite see exactly where you were throwing the ball?
Well, when I went back for the ball, usually a ball hooks towards the line, hit from a left-hander or a right-hander. And it, I broke back, and I'm kind of edging towards the line, but the ball stayed straight, so it got behind me. And the catch itself, I know that's not the question you asked, I'll get to that, but the catch itself for me was an awkward catch, because I lost the ball for 2 or 3 feet behind my head. The ball actually got behind me because it stayed straight, and I couldn't work myself back to get in line with the ball. So I jump up and I throw my glove up behind my head, lose sight of it for that, and it landed in my glove. So I turn around, and first thing I look at, I'm looking back towards third base, but right above third base are the lights. And the first thing I look at is the lights, and it's like looking into the sun. So I'm blinded. And for just, you know, seconds. And I threw it back towards first base, and it was 20 feet off, but it wasn't that bad of a throw, but plenty of time because Griffey was already, as Griffey Sr., was already, you know, at third base. So, and then Burleson came over from shortstop, and Yaz just flipped it to Burleson, and the end of the inning. So that's the reason why I threw it a little bit off, because I was blinded by the light.
And you guys thought after that 75 World Series that with the team you had, this was going to be a regular thing, that there would be World Series appearances on a regular basis, right?
I thought so. You know, we went into Oakland and, you know, we're playing, they had just won 3 World Championships and we weren't supposed to be in that ballpark with them. We sweep them three straight. Then we go to Cincinnati or go against Cincinnati in Boston and we're playing a big red machine. And we were not supposed to be in the same ballpark as them, but we proved, you know, that World Series, at, you know, the 7th game, the 8th inning, Morgan hits a bloop single to left center that goes off the end of his bat, and we lose by 1 run. So, yeah, we felt that, you know, we didn't like losing and being the bridesmaid of that World Series, but we felt we're going to be back here in the next 5 years, three or four times. And we'll win a world championship, but I didn't play in another World Series until 1986. And it's a shame with all the talent we had in the 80s or the 70s, 75 on to 80, that we didn't get to the World Series again. I was just blown away by that.
I want to talk about a couple of guys who had a big influence on your career. Can you, first of all, explain how Ralph Houk changed your career?
The major. Ralph Houk was called the major because he fought for Patton in World War II in Italy. And I always said that Ralph Houk could run IBM or some Amazon or some huge company because he knew how to treat people. And and he knew how to motivate people. So spring training of 1981, he's our manager. He calls me into his office, shuts the door, and he goes, "You've been hitting fifth, sixth, and seventh, and you lead the team in on-base percentage, you know, for the last few years." He goes, "I'm going to hit you second because you're going to get one more at-bat per game." And I ended up getting like 150 more at-bats than I normally would than hitting where I was hitting. And all of a sudden, I had more home runs. All of a sudden, I had more RBIs. All of a sudden, I had more extra base hit. So he turned me around, but he had ways of just lifting me. I can remember I was in a slump, and we're at Fenway, and I was still playing. You know, I could separate defense from offense. And he calls me in his office, shuts the door. And he always had a cigar in his mouth, too. He loved his cigars. And he goes, "You know what? You're the best right fielder in the game." He goes, "You just go out there. You're going to play every day. You just keep going out there. I'll handle the press." And he goes, "Remember, kid," let me talk a little bit more. He goes, I get up and I go to walk out. He goes, "Remember, kid, hits are like bananas." And I went, I shut the door and I opened the door back up real quick and I go, "Hits are like bananas." And he's laughing with his cigar in his hand. He goes, "They come in bunches, kid. They come in bunches." He just had a way of making you feel good. And he was the guy that was behind Mantle and Maris. And yeah. When Maris ended up hitting 61 home runs in 61.
And he had a presence, too. I was down there as a young radio guy that spring training. And I remember just walking by him before a game down on the field. And there was just an authority and a presence of that man as he walked by.
He did. He had a great presence about him. And even at his age then, he was still, if someone did something wrong against his player, he'd fight. He was ready to fight. he was fun to be around and a very emotional guy, but held his emotions close to him. And he loved his players. But I was trying to get into a story where he was a guy that was behind hitting Maris in front of Mantle.
Right.
And if you know, when Maris hit 61 home runs, Mantle hit 56.
Yeah.
55 or 56. And so everybody knew that if you put Mantle in front of Maris, they would have walked Mantle to get to Maris. But they had to, by him putting Maris in front of Mantle, they didn't want to walk Maris to get to Mantle. Mm. So they had to pitch to Maris. And anyway, just a great manager. And I'm not the only one that said that. He actually coached or managed in Detroit and other places. And you'd hear guys like Alan Trammell say he's the best manager he ever played for. So, and he played for, you know, Sparky Anderson, great managers as well. Alan Trammell did. So I had, you know, Zim was a great manager. Don Zimmer, he was probably the best baseball man I ever played for. John McNamara was a good manager. Daryl Johnson had me in AAA. I connected with him. And I had a lot of wonderful people that I played for. Zim, on the other hand, was the best baseball, but he didn't like me as a player. He just, you know, wanted different style players. And I had said that to Fred Lynn about 15 years ago. I said, "I don't know what it was, Freddie, was Zim. He just always wanted to trade me." Freddie kind of pushes my shoulder. He goes, "He always wanted to trade me too," you know? So I wasn't the only one, but he was, I learned more from him on the field than anybody I ever played for.
Well, in the 80s, you were about as productive a hitter as there was. You had more extra base hits than anybody in baseball, more home runs than anybody in the American League. How much of a factor was the guidance and the tutelage of Walt Reniac in all of that?
Oh, huge. Walt was, you know, just a huge part of my career. And I remember I was hitting like 180 something, and it's almost all star break. And I was just in a horrible slump, not really having any change my stance every other day or every at bat, trying to adjust. And I was beamed in 78, hit right behind my left ear, where I was knocked out, and I woke up in the hospital, and my head never hurt like that. But I had an inner ear issue where I'd be dizzy. And I can't think of the name of it right now. As I get older, I can't think of the name of it. But there's a name for it. There's some balance off in your head.
Well, vertigo?
Vertigo. Thank you. It's going to take both of us to finish this interview.
Oh, we're a team. We're a team. We can do it.
Yeah. Vertigo, I had it for almost 3 years. And that was part of it. I was afraid of getting hit. Not so much of the pain, but more of having vertigo, which was just, you know, so bad. I mean, I can remember being in right field in 78, 5 days after I got beamed, and they hadn't invented the word concussion back then. They just, you know, I had a severe concussion. They invented it. I'm just being sarcastic with that, but they invented that. They just didn't do what they do today. You would play for 2 or 3 weeks. But I played, you know, I actually three nights later pinch hit and got a base hit up the middle. But just putting my head up and looking up, I'd start spinning. Looking to the side, I could use my, if I kept my head balanced and I could use my eyes to look up. But if it got above my eyes, I had to lift my head up. And when that happened, I'd start spinning. And then I made so many errors the last month and a half. And then they finally just couldn't play. But I remember I went out and a ball was hit to me and I had to look up and I'm seeing 4 or 5 balls. And I'm dizzy and it hits me in the chest. I try to cradle it and the ball hit the ground and there. So I come in and Zim's right in my face. What happened on that ball? I said, Zim, I'm seeing 4 or 5 balls. When I look up, he goes, well, I catch the one in the middle. Here's a guy that was being seriously.
Right. Had a plate in his head.
Yeah. And he had no sympathy for me, but I never wanted sympathy. I never wanted that. I had a serious vertigo problem. And there's people out there that know anything about vertigo. It's not fun. It's you roll over in bed and you start spinning, you get sick, or you walk off a curb or whatever in the street, you're spinning, and it was a real challenge. So I didn't, the reason I brought that up is because of Walt. And so I was really afraid of getting hit. So Walt got me balanced in my stance where I never got hit in the head again because I was balanced at the plate. But more importantly, we worked on other things too. We worked on not only balance, but also getting tension out of my body and looking for pitches in certain areas. That was all Walt's idea, but I took it and I ran with it and it worked. And like you just said, what I did in the 80s was, you know, there were some great players in it. George Brett in the 80s and Winfield and Mike Schmidt. I can go on and on with the great players in the 80s. And to know what I did in the 80s, I didn't know that until I got to Baltimore in 91. No one from the Red Sox media ever said that I'd led the American League or not all of baseball and extra base hits and American League and home runs. I never heard that from the press in Boston. But I heard it when I went to Baltimore for that 1 year.
And speaking of that, your departure from Boston, tough after all those years in the system and made tougher because, as you point out, ownership never really gave you a chance to say goodbye to the fans.
I really did. I really wanted to, Rich. I wanted to I even said to him, because I had broke my back that year, stress fracture in my SI joint, which is low in your back. And it would fuse itself on its on itself. I mean, it healed itself on the inside of my pelvis. And every time I slid, it'd break. So I was in severe pain. And I didn't know if they were going to bring me back, but I asked in the last couple of weeks, I said, if you're not going to bring me back, I just want to say thank you to the fans. I don't want any ordeal. I just want to say thank you. And I'd appreciate if you gave me that opportunity. And they never did. In fact, I came into the ballpark like 2 days after the season, and I had to get some things out of my locker and just clean up things. And when here I turn around, there's Al Forrester, a ground crew guy, taps me on the shoulder, says, "Dewey, Lou Gorman wants you up in his office." And I'm getting the message from ground crew guy, and which is fine. It's not his fault. So I go up and I see Lou, and Joe Morgan's there, and he says, "We're not gonna extend your contract. We're gonna let you go." They didn't say let me go. They said, "We're not going to renew your contract." Okay, and I got up, shook hands with him and Joe Morgan, and walked out of there stunned, because I just felt that, you know, if they had asked me to retire, I would have retired. And they never did. It wouldn't, with this, and I know this ownership well, John Henry's group, they never would have done that. They might have done things other ways, but they would have appreciated, you know, 19 years in Boston. They would have appreciated that. They're just so
well. Yeah, and you point that out with what they did and surprised you with after the 2004 championship.
Yes. Oh gosh, it's 2005, and it's early in the year, and I have my son Tim with me. I usually go there and I do that legend suite where I entertain, you know, 15 to 25 people for like 4 or 5 innings. And then, but Tim came with me, but I'm up there and it's like the second inning and between innings, and they come in, and John Henry and Larry Lucchino, and behind him is a camera with the lights. And they hand me this beautiful wooden box, you know, and I open it up, and there's a world championship ring for 2004. I mean, that just, Tim, my son, was so proud of me as well. But that was a proud moment for me. Just the way they treated me. And of course, they did the same thing in 2007 and 2013 and 2018. So they're a wonderful organization, wonderful owners. So I appreciate them more than you can believe. So
you reached a point where the medical challenges of Timothy and Justin were really taking a toll on your marriage. Can you talk about how faith helped bring you and Susan to a new place?
Yeah. Well, Susan was brought up in church. I wasn't. I wasn't even baptized. My mother and father, we had 5 siblings. I was the 4th of 5. My mother would say, well, we just didn't know. She was Episcopalian, and my father was a Mormon, but he was not practicing. They both weren't practicing. So I didn't grow up in a house that went to church. So when this kind of happened to us in the almost the late 70s and then 1980 is when we changed things around. I mean, Susan was really almost just a step away from anorexic, and would smoke 3 packs a day, and she'd always say the only thing I could control was the food I eat. Mm-hmm. I couldn't control anything else. Couldn't control the pain of my boys. Couldn't control the disease they had. So it was a tough time in our marriage, and we weren't happy with each other. And 1980, I'm in Oakland, about 11 o'clock in the morning. And I would always read my Bible. And because I always thought, well, you know, I'm not a bad guy. I'm not bad enough to go to hell. I'm not, you know, I'm a decent guy. But I didn't know what I had to do. And it was Revelation. I was reading Revelations, and I read Revelations 3, 15 and 16 talks about, you know, I wish you were either hot nor cold, but since you were lukewarm, I spit you out of my mouth. And I didn't want to be lukewarm. I did not want to be lukewarm. And so right then I got on my knees and I just asked the Lord to come into my life. And that was something that was between me and I really hadn't talked to Susan about it, but that same day, three people came to that front door, and they came from Pittsburgh.
That's an amazing story, by the way.
Well, it is. And they came from Pittsburgh, and two black guys and a white guy, and they had $20 in their wallet, left Pittsburgh, left their church. They'd read a story about us, and it went nationwide about the kids being with MF and all that. But they had read that, and they made their way to Linfield. And they got to Fenway Park, and each time they got somewhere, they always said, well, God has sent us. God has sent us. So they get to Fenway Park, and of course, we're out of town, and they say, well, where is Dwight Evans? But we can't tell you that. And then they say, well, God has sent us. We have a message for him. He says, well, he lives in Linfield. And they give him some money, gas money, because they didn't have any money. And then they get to the fire station in Linfield. And they said, where does Dwight Evans live? And they said, well, we can't tell you that. They said, well, God has sent us. We have a message for them. They said, well, he lives on 3 Jordan Road. And they knock on the door. It's about 2 o'clock, almost 11 o'clock in Oakland. I'm going through my thing. And it's around 2 o'clock in on the East Coast. And they knock on the door, and Susan kind of doesn't know if she wants to let them in or not. And then finally they go, the Lord has a message for you. And we've come from Pittsburgh. So they ended up just praying over her and witnessing to her. And she stopped smoking. She hadn't had a cigarette since then. That was 1980. And she started eating right. She started taking care of herself. But we had talked, but we hadn't. I got something to tell you, and I'm going to wait till I get home to tell you, and I want to be in front of you and let you know what's going on with me. She says, I have something to tell you, too. And I said, well, we finally went to the Union Oyster House in Boston, and we sat in a booth, and it was always, and there's a plaque that says, this is where John F. Kennedy had his meals at Union Oyster House, one of the oldest restaurants in the country. And so we're sitting there, and we're kind of going, I got something to tell you. So I let her talk. She tells me that story I just told you about the three men. And I told her a story about me. And then our life had just turned around. Then we were serving God. We weren't serving each other. And, yeah, do you go through things? Absolutely. But we answered to God and wasn't answering to ourselves. And our marriage turned around and healed our marriage. And here we are. September will be 54 years. So, and I think everybody, Rich, everybody has, you know, problems in a marriage. And if it's just you two and you don't have God involved, I don't know how people survive. It's just maybe two special people that, you know, I've heard people never argue or whatever. And, you know, I don't know that one. But marriage, I said, marriage is not 50-50.
Right.
Marriage is 100-100. If you both don't give 100%, you're still going to have issues, but you have commitment there. And that's what it's all about. Is you marry for better or for worse. Sickness and health, you know. It doesn't say, well, you marry and I dislike you, or we're not getting along, I'm leaving, I'm going this way, you go that way. No, that's not commitment. Marriage is it's a powerful bond. A powerful bond, and we take it very seriously. We don't take our marriage lightly.
Susan had a pretty serious health scare a couple of years back. You got through that, and I get the sense from reading the book that you're at peace with whatever the future holds.
Yes, I'm here to tell you that Susan is doing well. She's had diagnosed with cancer above her pancreas. And they found the cancer, and they identified it, and it affects 1 in 40 million people. Very rare. They didn't know how to treat it. They didn't think they could treat it with chemo or radiation, and she wasn't going to do that. But they were going to do surgery on her, and it was really a tough surgery, which all are in the abdomen. But they went deep, and they took out things, and just, again, above the pancreas, and they feel that they got it, but still has issues in that area, but we're not hearing cancer anymore. And at that time, I was thinking about life without Susan. I wasn't happy about it. And we had been 52 years, and I said, well, how long does it last? How long does a marriage last? I've been blessed to have her this long. And I was trying to rationalize losing our two sons and then facing losing my wife. And it was not a good moment. I'm so happy, and I feel so blessed to have her in my life as long as I have. And a very special woman. She's still a very, very attractive woman, and she is got a sense of humor. She's got a smile that lights up a room, and greenish eyes. Just a beautiful, blonde-haired, beautiful woman.
Speaking of looks, I saw a picture recently of you and Freddie Lynn and Jim Rice. You guys don't age. What's the secret of you three?
I don't know. You know, I look at myself and I go, man, you're getting old. you know, we get together maybe once a year, but Jimmy and I are around each other a lot more. We're in spring training for 40-some days, and we have a good friendship, good relationship. And again, we played 16 years together. Freddie looks great, and Jimmy and I always, because Freddie wouldn't play unless he was 100%. And we'd always get on him and say, Freddie, you got to play. I don't care if you're 80%. You're probably the best 80% player in all of baseball. But he says, I just can't perform the way I want to. So Jimmy said two knees replaced. I've had shoulder surgery, elbow surgery. I've had knee replaced. I've had other knee operations. I had 9 surgeries before I had it replaced. And Jimmy and I just, you know, we never would have played if we were always 100%. But we always were kind of mad at Freddie in a way, because we said, he's smarter than us. And so he finally, Rich, this past off season, had both knees. He had the both knees done, not total replacement, but both knees with a not a total replacement. But Jimmy and I kind of high fived each other and said, "It got him too." Because he played a long time as well.
He did.
We have a good time when we get together. We really do. And Freddie said something. I know you got other questions, Rich, but Freddie said something to me about 15 years ago, and he said, "Dewey, you know that our outfield was the best of all time." I said, "Well, how can you say that? I mean, look at Willie Mays and look at Bobby Bonds. Look at Mickey Mantle and Maris." And I went on with these. Look at Clemente, and he goes, "Yeah, but they didn't have 3 solid outfields. They always had. It was always Mays and Bonds, and then it was one of the Alou brothers or someone else, and it wasn't anybody for any period of time. The same thing with Mantle and Maris. And if you look at it, don't go by my. But I now think that Freddie is right in saying what he said, because I can look at every outfield in history and go, nobody was like the 3 of us. And, you know, we ended up having, you know, well over 1,000 home runs, and I don't know how many RBIs between the 3 of us, but I would say close to, you know, over 5,000. Mm. Just a lot of things that, and I could be wrong on those numbers. I don't have anything in front of me to really document it, but I listen to Freddie, and I tend to agree with him.
I wanted to ask you about this year's group. It's been a surprising year, and so much of it carried by the young guys. Who do you like a lot among these young Red Sox hitters this year?
Wow. Well, Duran has arrived, and here's a kid that I spent a lot of time with. When I say with, I don't mean I would talk to him, but it's been 7 years, and to see him do what he's doing is just off the charts. And they're in a little slump right now. They're actually playing some good baseball. I think they've lost six in a row. Now they've got the Yankees. But in those six games, I think they had a couple of extra inning games, and they lost by one run. And the other ones, there was, I think, one or two other that they got blown out. But they're not playing bad baseball. They're playing pretty good baseball. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy that they signed Cora to that contract. He's one of the best in all of baseball. So, Rafaela at shortstop. And, I talked to Chad Epperson, the manager in Portland in spring training. I asked him about Rafaela, and he said, Dewey, he'll probably win 8 to 10 gold gloves. He's 22 years old. He can play shortstop, and he can play center field, and he's got a good arm. And I said, well, I'll watch him and I'll see. And in spring training, not so much. Runs well, kind of wild at the plate, but he has come in and dialed in. And at 22 years old, this kid can play shortstop and he can play center field, and with the best of them. And he's hit some big home runs for us too. So I think he's going to, as he matures, he's going to get better and better at the plate. He's a very special athlete. So, a couple of young guys like that. We've got other guys too. Abreu, we got from Houston a few years back out of AA. And strong kid, really good arm, good outfielder, and is becoming a pretty good hitter as well. So there's some guys. I'm trying to think of guys in my mind. I'm trying to think of who else, and our catching is great. I mean, Wong is, Wong's really impressed me, and how his discipline at the plate. And I'm, and you've got Devers. I'm not trying to overlook anybody, and it's just that they're guys that this team wasn't picked to do anything in spring training. I think they've been really fun to watch. They've given me a lot of joy, and seeing guys kind of mature a little bit. It's neat. They're a fun club to watch.
Indeed. Well, speaking of joy, you gave us, so many of us, so much joy in your long career in Major League Baseball. Always one of my favorite players. You belong in the Hall of Fame, no question in my mind there. But after reading the book, even more respect for you. And Susan, and the way you've lived your life. It's a wonderful read. Congratulations to you and Eric on this terrific book. And thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Dwight.
Rich, thank you. I appreciate the questions and the time you've allotted me. I've heard so much about you. I can't get you on the radio, but maybe I can. I don't know if I can or not, but I'd like to know that. Love the interview. Thank you, Rich. It was a pleasure being with you.